50 Years of Saving Lives, the book. Narrated by Mike Fronczek.
We're picking up about midway, a little further than midway, through Chapter 1 of 50 Years of Saving Lives. We're at the tail end of the portion called The Pornification of America, and we continue reading here. Where there is casual, freewheeling sex, uncomplicated by messy and restrictive moral codes or commitments like engagement and matrimony, there is often unwanted pregnancy and abortion. Men who lived the Playboy lifestyle certainly couldn't be bothered with marriage and children. A convenient fix for those pesky pregnancies was touted by Playboy in 1965 when it ran a Julian Huxley feature that supported abortion. The Huxley piece appeared 8 years prior to the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision. The same year the magazine came out in favor of a woman's right to choose, Hefner founded the Playboy Foundation, a nonprofit that gave money to the Kinsey Human Sexuality Research Institute, rape crisis centers, and the Clergy Consultation Service, an organization that connected women with abortion services. After the Playboy Foundation donated to the ACLU Women's Rights Project, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, then an attorney at the ACLU and later a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, co-signed a thank you note published in the August 1973 issue, which read, "The ACLU fought for the right to abortion long before the U.S. Supreme Court's landmark decision. Now we advocate abortions and birth control for minors without parental consent." The way their grandparents had stashed cash under their mattresses, a wide swath of American adolescent boys now hid the forbidden fruit of pornographic magazines. Not only was the cultural impact of Playboy magazine, along with its thousands of imitators, a devastating blow to America's moral underpinnings, it greased the skids of the country's rapid slide toward legalized abortion on demand. David French, writing in the National Review, suggests that Hugh Hefner's legacy is one of despair. He said, "Hefner didn't invent pornography, and it would no doubt be thriving today even if he hadn't founded Playboy magazine those many years ago. After all, man is fallen, and somebody would have filled that depraved niche in American life. Hefner, however, played his part, and the part he played was immensely destructive to our nation's cultural, moral, and spiritual fabric. Hefner mainstreamed porn. He put it in millions of homes, and he even glamorized it, recasting one of America's most pathetic industries as the playground of the sophisticated rich. The effects have lasted a lifetime. Boys grew up believing they were entitled to sex on demand, and the sex would always be amazing. They learned to grow bored of the same old thing, and instead to seek new adventures. They learned that monogamy was confining, that promiscuity was liberating, and that women should always be hot. The normal female form was no longer enough. It had to be enhanced, sculpted, and waxed. To see men become addicted to porn is to watch character formation in reverse. Their integrity and fidelity unwind before your eyes. Everyone has seen it happen in their churches, in their neighborhoods, and in their families. A-list celebrities were the people setting the tone for the American culture. These were the people mocking the values that kept families strong. These were the people who were teaching a nation that fulfillment could be found in sex and that the joy of sex was worth more than marriage itself. The cultural harm done is even now ripping kids from parents and husbands from wives. when I think of Hugh Hefner, yes, I mourn, but I mourn because the bitter fruit of his life's work has helped poison the families of people I know and love. He is gone, but his legacy lives on, and his is a legacy of despair. That ends the quote from David French, writing in the National Review. The most powerful weapon in the sexual revolution's arsenal was the media. During the 60s, things once only whispered about in the privacy of darkness were brought to the flickering light of late-night television and tittered about the next day around the water cooler. You are listening to a reading of Chapter 1 from the Wisconsin Right to Life 50th Anniversary book, 50 Years of Saving Lives. The modern consensus is that the sexual revolution in 1960s America was typified by a dramatic shift in traditional values related to sex and sexuality. Sex became more socially acceptable outside the strict boundaries of heterosexual marriage. In 1969, Blue Movie, directed by Andy Warhol, was the first adult erotic film depicting explicit sex to receive wide theatrical release in the United States. The film helped inaugurate the porno chic phenomenon in modern American culture. During this time, porn was being publicly discussed by celebrities and taken seriously by critics. According to Warhol, Blue Movie was a major influence in the making of Last Tango in Paris, an internationally controversial erotic drama film starring Marlon Brando and released a few years after Blue Movie was made. In 1970, Mona, the second adult erotic film depicting explicit sex, received a wide theatrical release in the United States, following mentions by Johnny Carson on his popular TV show and Bob Hope on TV as well. The adult film Deep Throat achieved major box office success. Of course, this so-called revolution did not occur without consequences. Perhaps casualties would be the better word. Full access to abortion on demand was a necessary component of a casual sex-on-demand culture. Over the next half century, the U.S. death toll from abortion would reach nearly 60 million. In 1980, in Wisconsin alone, the annual abortion numbers were estimated to be at an all-time high of 21,754. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Abortion as a political platform plank and as a generation-decimating, profit-driven industry would not evolve into its present form until its proponents launched their legislative onslaught and began challenging abortion laws in court. These two strategies may not have succeeded on their own had not one other significant piece of the American abortion puzzle fallen into place. That happened when two men convinced one woman that abortion should be part and parcel of the American feminist movement. The hijacking of feminism. History has a funny way of being rewritten to serve the needs of the present day. No case of liberal revisionism is more obvious than the suggestion that standing for women's rights automatically means being a proponent for abortion on demand. Nothing could be further from the truth. For example, was the women's movement pro-abortion in the mid to late 1800s, when Susan B. Anthony and friends were fighting for the right to vote for women? Answer, no. Was the women's movement pro-abortion in 1920, when the 19th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified, granting women the vote? No. was the women's movement pro-abortion in 1963 when Betty Friedan released her best-selling book on the struggles of American women, The Feminine Mystique? No. In fact, neither the words abortion nor reproductive rights appear within the covers of the first edition of The Feminine Mystique. Women identified as part of the millennial generation born between 1977 and 1995 would not recognize American society a few brief decades earlier, much less the America of 1895. Women at the turn of the century could not vote, own property or sit on a jury, hold a personal bank account or take out a loan, keep their job if they married or became pregnant, easily get into or find a co-ed college, enter graduate programs at Ivy League colleges, get a divorce without proving infidelity or abuse, or work overtime or at night. Today, such discriminatory restrictions on women sound like they come not from another era, but from another world. Were it not for the early valiant efforts of those in the women's movement, much of the equality women enjoy in today's America would be non-existent. On the other hand, the moral authority of feminists must be challenged with this question: is feminism to blame for the nearly 60 million babies lost to abortion? Clearly, in large part, the answer to this question is yes. Ironically, however, it was the heavy influence of two men which hijacked feminism, transforming it from a pro-woman movement into a pro-abortion movement. As past president of Feminists for Life, Rosemary Ulrich Betcher, wrote, "It has become common to view a right to abortion as the centerpiece of women's rights in general. The push to legalize abortion is popularly considered the vanguard of the women's rights movement that emerged in the early 70s, but this view is wrong." Dr. Bernard Nathanson, the one-time abortion advocate who had an excruciating change of heart, was, by his own admission, not much of a feminist. His commitment to legalizing abortion arose from his disgust for the medically sloppy consequences of the illegal abortions that he witnessed as a young intern. In 1967, his private disgust began to morph into public activism when he met Larry Leder, a disciple of Margaret Sanger, at a dinner party. Leder wasn't, Nathanson has explained, much of a feminist either. He was dedicated to removing all obstacles to abortion, legal, social, and moral, because he was convinced that abortion was an essential component of solving the looming problems of overpopulation and, as his 1971 book title proclaimed, breeding ourselves to death. This chance meeting between Leder and Nathanson resulted in the conception of NARAL, the National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws. Nathanson and Leder tenaciously lobbied state legislatures, especially in their home state of New York, to repeal nearly all prohibitions against abortion. Nathanson later admitted that they resorted to some rather unscrupulous tactics. He wrote, for example, that they simply made up the number of women that had died from illegal abortions. Quote, "It was always 5,000 to 10,000 deaths a year. I confess I knew the figures were totally false. The overriding concern was to get the laws eliminated, and anything within reason that had to be done was permissible." End quote. But their efforts were not very successful until Leder had a brilliant idea, linking legal abortion to the burgeoning feminist movement. The first edition of Betty Friedan's seminal book, The Feminine Mystique, did not even mention abortion. Legalizing abortion was not on the newborn now's list of issues. In his 1979 book, Aborting America, Dr. Nathanson recalled later saying, quote, "If we're going to move abortion out of the books and onto the streets, we're going to have to recruit the feminists. for Dan has got to put her troops into this thing while she still has control of them." End quote. At the National Right to Life Convention in June 1986, Nathanson admitted to the convention attendees that they convinced the leaders of NOW that easy access to legal abortion was essential to ameliorating the problems that were thwarting the well-being of women. The problems that Friedan had identified in her book. Quote, "We got them to see legal abortion as a civil rights issue, a basic women's rights issue," Nathanson explained. In Nathanson's earlier words, quote, "Later's marriage with the feminists was a brilliant tactic," end quote. Abortion has been NOW's cardinal cause ever since. Nathanson spent the last third of his life trying to undo what he had done to promote and entrench abortion into our culture. I know that he suffered excruciating moral pain over acknowledging his role in enabling the deaths of millions of unborn humans. His journey from abortion apologist to pro-life activist was a fascinating one, one that gives us hope that any person with an open mind and an honest heart can find a way to truth. That ends the long quote from past president of Feminist for Life, Rosemary Ulrich Betcher. Nathanson and later selling the pro-women movement the myth that somehow abortion on demand was a good thing for American women will forever stand as one of the deadliest lies in American history. When men tell women that killing their children is a form of freedom, then Hitler's axiom of the big lie is proven true. It should be noted that had Nathanson and later not made their so-called contribution to the conversion of the women's rights movement into the pro-abortion movement, the influence of the followers of Margaret Sanger, founder of Planned Parenthood, undoubtedly would have had a similar effect. As early as 1914, Sanger's first magazine, The Woman Rebel, was promoting abortion as a pathway to, quote, freedom, end quote, for women. Quote, "If a woman is to free herself effectively, she must make herself absolute mistress of her own body. She must recognize her absolute right to suppress the germ of life," end quote. The 60s in hindsight. Somewhere along the road from President Kennedy's assassination in downtown Dallas to the purple haze of the Woodstock Music Festival in rural New York, America took a hard left turn. Wisconsin was along for the ride in ways even more profound than most other states. Anti-war demonstrations and civil rights marches were commonplace in the mid-1960s. Wisconsin Governor Warren P. Knowles called out the National Guard to keep order during civil rights demonstrations in Wauwatosa. Anti-war protests devolved into a riot on the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. An opening day of a special legislative session on welfare and urban AIDS in 1969, welfare mothers and UW-Madison students, led by Father James Groppi, took over the assembly chamber. The National Guard was called in to protect the Capitol building. In 1967, with our nation wrestling with all kinds of change and unrest, Colorado became the first state to decriminalize abortion in cases of rape, incest, or in which pregnancy would lead to permanent physical disability of the woman. Similar laws were passed in California, Oregon, and North Carolina. 3 years later, Alaska, Hawaii, New York, and Washington liberalized their abortion laws, making abortion available at the request of a woman and her doctor. Abortionists from states with more lenient laws invited women from other states to fly in, have their abortion, and fly home for a packaged fee airfare included. Wisconsin and our nation were saying yes to things that were unthinkable just one decade earlier. Milwaukee Archbishop William E. Cousins could see the handwriting on the wall, and in 1967 formed a steering committee to assess the pending legal and legislative threats by pro-abortion forces to Wisconsin's then 120-year-old abortion ban known as State Statute 940.04. Cousins wanted to know, both from a medical and legal standpoint, where Wisconsin stood on protecting the sanctity of human life. Could Wisconsin's state legislature be the next to give in to the pressure for more liberalized abortion laws? In politics, as in gambling, there is no such thing as a sure thing. The Archbishop wanted to know for certain what might be looming on the legislative horizon, so he called in some of the best minds to do the research, come to a conclusion, and advise appropriate action. The steering committee, meeting in November of 1967, was a who's who of Catholic clergy and lay leaders. Father Francis Bassinius was present, as were Father Fred Hauser, Drs. John Brennan and John Mullooly, as well as Robert Herzog, and then Milwaukee Assistant District Attorney E. Michael McCann. Change was in the air, McCann said in a personal interview. From what I recall of sitting on that committee, the Archbishop's main concern was a legislative challenge to our existing law. So that was our primary focus, end quote. Later, when McCann became district attorney, he was replaced on the committee by Dennis Pertell. By 1968, the original steering committee's work had culminated with a gathering of 49 people from 27 organizations. This coterie formed a functioning group aimed at conducting a campaign against abortion. It was at this September 9, 1968 gathering that Wisconsin Right to Life was officially formed, then named Wisconsin Citizens Concerned for the Unborn. The organization's stated purpose was to carry out statewide educational and legislative efforts in opposition to abortion. Specifically, they were to mobilize public opinion on the rights of the unborn and to champion these rights on the legislative level. By 1969, extensive plans had been laid for a statewide organization, with Archbishop Cousins reaching out to Wisconsin's bishops, seeking their assistance in selecting laypeople of their diocese to serve in the effort on the local level. Father Donald N. Weber, born 1922, died 2007, then the director of the Archdiocese of Milwaukee's Catholic Family Life Program, was elected as temporary chairman of the group. He later became its secretary, a position later re-identified as executive director. He served in this capacity from 1968 until 1972. In the five decades following the turmoil of the 60s, the scourge of abortion on Wisconsin women, children, men, and families has crested and receded, in large part due to the tireless work of the dedicated people of Wisconsin Right to Life. The sad fact is, from a historical perspective, as the clock struck midnight on December 31, 1969, and the 60s dissolved into the 70s, things were going to get much worse before they got better. In the short span of 24 months and 22 days, America would be forever changed again, but this time not from bullets or music or porn. It would be changed by seven men in black. And that is the end of Chapter 1 from Wisconsin Right to Life's 50th anniversary book, 50 Years of Saving Lives.